Welcome to Vistage Live, the place you can come to for insights, knowledge and perspectives from a range of experts who can help your small and mid-sized business make a great big impact. Today we're joined by Ron Gauci, Vistage Chair, seasoned CEO and transformation specialist. With a leadership career spanning Telstra, IBM and Microsoft, and iconic turnarounds at the Melbourne Storm, Melbourne Polytechnic and Federation Square. Ron brings sharp insights into what it takes to lead through complexity. He now supports business owners and executives through his consultancy, Ausmuse, board roles and his work as a trusted advisor. Tune in as we explore Ron's approach to resilient leadership, strategic transformation, and what he's learned from guiding organizations through their toughest moments. Ron, welcome to Vistage Live.
Thank you, Steph. Good morning.
Good morning. So I hear you have a vocal range of 3.5 octaves.
I do. Is that where we're going to start?
I think so. I just feel like music. Well, you know, the tune in tuned me in.
Right.
So how long have you been a musician?
I started playing at the age of 12.
Right.
I'm 66 now, so you do the maths.
Yeah.
And I've been fortunate to have been involved in some great experiences involving music.
And did you do music? Did you study music through school or it was always a hobby?
I was one of those really lucky people to have had a teacher. He was a Christian brother.
Yeah.
I had a positive experience.
and he
identified a talent and he introduced me to a whole range of instruments. So I was very fortunate to move from brass sections to strings to percussion and I was able to set up a studio at home, which I still have to this day, a variety of instruments. These days I introduce all those sounds to my grandchildren, but music has created a great opportunity for me to get through some of the toughest times and also the most enjoyable times.
It's really good. Thanks for that. On the way here, we were talking about your playlist and we don't need to go into that now, but yeah, it was good. It was really energizing.
Well, people like to hear music that they know and familiar with, so that's what we do.
They do, especially on a dance floor. Yes. So, Ron, you just alluded to the toughest times. And in your career, you've been involved in a number of turnarounds. That was probably your badge of honour or what you're really known for
yes.
a while there. What does it mean to turn around a business?
And a turnaround doesn't have to be in a crisis situation, although that's typically where I have been brought in. But a turnaround can occur even for businesses that are doing reasonably well but want to do far better. So I think people do tend to link turnarounds with a crisis or adversity situation, but that's not necessarily the case. I think where businesses have performed what I would say in a mediocre manner, that there's a great opportunity for a turnaround there. And a turnaround for me is where you identify what the potential of the business is and then realise that potential.
So how did you get this reputation? Mm-hmm. How did people know, well, let's get, you know, Mr. Fix-It in, how did they know that?
Well, I've been fixing problems and solving problems ever since I was a teenager. My parents are migrant people that worked throughout the day and then at night, and I'm the oldest of six, so it was my responsibility to get people through things and get the kids through and get them ready for school and the like. So for me, it was solving problems from an early age. And then I found in my teenage years, I was doing the same thing with my sporting connections. But to answer your question, from a corporate perspective, I was in an organization where a crisis had hit a customer and I was identified as the person to lead the recovery of that business on behalf of the client. And we did that in an exceptional time frame with an exceptional outcome. And I think that's where the reputation of Mr. Fix-It stuck. And then after that, I was given the next challenge. And all those challenges ever did was reinforce the tagline, if you like.
So is there a model that you turn to, a kind of a
explicit model or something that you think through, a process you think through when you go into an organization?
Yeah, great question. And it's a great question because a lot of people I know that have been involved in turnarounds and say that they solve problems tend to use a model. I can honestly say that I've not replicated any method or model for any of the projects that I've been involved in. See, the art is to be able to adopt and adapt very quickly and to have an understanding of the situation that you've got at hand. Mm. So anytime I've walked into an organization, I do have a method, which is 30 days of observation, 30 days of planning, and then 30 days of execution, or stage 1, 2, and 3. So what I spend in that first 30 days is the key to what happens next. And as I say, each time I've had to deploy a different strategy or a different solution set using different skill sets or different people or systems and processes. So
depending on the first 30 days of the understanding.
Absolutely.
And so what are you looking for? What? Let me take it back a step. When you walk into an organization that's maybe not in crisis, that there's opportunities,
yeah.
What are you scanning for at first?
Yeah, well, sometimes too, I might add that there isn't a crisis.
Yeah.
But the beauty of a crisis is that everyone realizes that action is required.
Yes.
So I also learned during the time that sometimes you need to create a crisis to get people to work.
Oh, tell me about that.
Well, we may come to that.
We will. Okay. But that right. was really interesting.
Yeah, no, I learned a long time ago, sometimes you just need to create the impression that there's a crisis to get people focused. So to go back to your question, what I look for is what is the actual problem or what is the opportunity, right? So why are we here in the first place? And why do people think that there's either an opportunity or a crisis to be resolved? So then we look at what it is that people want from that process. So what does success look like? I find that far too often in business, no one can define what success looks like.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I can talk to a dozen people in the organization and I'll get a dozen different answers as to what their business is about and what the problem is and the likes. I'll then start playing with proposed solutions and road test those. What I'm also looking for inside the organization is the capability and capacity to actually execute. So what that might start with, what's the mindset of the people? What is the culture of the place? What people do they have in what positions? Often when I come into a crisis situation, the organization looks like a bowl of spaghetti in terms of the structure, right? So is there a clarity around roles?
Mm.
Are people clear on their KPIs? So I learnt a long time ago, role clarity, accountability, and consequence, right? So if I'm doing well, what is the consequence? If I'm not doing well, what is the consequence? So I think that they're the things I look for, and then I'll have a look at the systems and processes behind to actually execute.
So execution you talked about, and you talked about, I mean, obviously there's strategy implementation.
Yeah.
So what does phase two look like?
So the important part is to put the plan together in a way that you can easily execute.
Yeah.
But you also need to get buy-in.
Well, I was going to say, because you need other people to execute as well.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, just do it all on
your own. When you do what I do as an interim executive, you know you're going to hand over.
Yeah.
So the handover process not only needs to be smooth and make sense, but hand over to people who are capable of doing the job. So I take a lot of pride in the people I put in place. I always look for people who can do their job better than I do, and all I need to do is look after them. Now, what I find in organizations is a Jim Collins thing called demotivators. So what are the things that actually stopping good people from being great? So I try and break down those barriers as well. So if there is a capacity and a capability, how do I unleash those people? And that second phase is when the opportunity is there to get the buy-in, get the ideas, get the innovation, the creativity that then you hand over and they go into execution mode.
So how often do you need to bring in people or compared with finding the talent within that just needs to be unleashed, yeah, to have the kind of barriers to success removed?
I find this part really amusing. I've been in situations where I've had boards that have brought me in, that have made it very clear these people need to go. They don't know how to have the hard conversation. You do, so could you do that for us? And in other situations, I've been told the team is great and they're not. But I do find it amusing when I've walked into an organisation and I've been told that these people aren't capable of doing the work, only to find that they're very, very capable. They just haven't had the resources, the tools or the support. So to answer your question, there are times when I do need to bring people in, and there are times when I can really leverage the people that are there by unleashing that potential.
What are the things that are often holding people back?
Those demotivators.
And what kind of things would they be?
So I did an exercise with an organisation where I had the executive team together, and we wanted to list the demotivators. I've got to say it was really tough when we got to the fifth page of the butcher paper, right? A demotivator looks like anything from a policy to an office layout to a financial issue or a culture or team dynamics. I mean, that's why you can actually fill a page. If you think about all the things that can demotivate a person from being the best they can, they can build up as a list. What I always find, though, is the executive team knows that it's a demotivator and hasn't done anything about resolving it.
Yes.
So to me, that's where you need to focus your attention. But if you hire really, really well and you know you've brought in a successful person, and then in your organisation they are not successful, then maybe they're not the problem. All right, so let's work out why it is that someone who's very talented, very capable, is not being as successful as you expect them to be.
Mm. So that's phase two. Phase three, execution. How do you go about that?
Right, so you need a very good strategy with the systems, processes and people to be able to then go and do. Define success, build in the must-dos. So these are the things we have to do in this time frame. And then it's all about management. And leadership and management are two separate concepts. The leadership is what gets you there. The management is what completes the execution.
Absolutely. Leadership and management are two very separate concepts, and people getting them confused or dipping in and out of one to the other can create confusion across the organisation or lack of clarity.
Yep.
So can we come back to when you said sometimes you have to manufacture a crisis?
Yes. So there have been situations where I've walked into an organisation that someone with a stakeholder interest has said, we're not doing the things we should be doing, or we're not realising the potential of the business, and my team is in a comfort zone, right? Or there is complacency. And that can happen too when you set numbers at a particular level and you achieve those numbers, only to find that you could have achieved significantly more, right?
Yeah.
So you need to get people pointed as to what you need to do to rectify the situation. So you can create a crisis by looking at a situation where you might decide to focus on a financial or a cultural thing and just hone in. Like a doctor does this really, really well.
Yeah.
They hone in on the pain point and they just keep pushing away at that pain point till you really feel it. You can do that in business as well. So you can identify those areas that are not going as well as they should do, and then you can create a crisis that way. And I've been in situations where people have moved from complacency to panic, right? And when you get that point of panic, that's when you know you can achieve things. All of the major projects I've worked on that have been the most successful, in my opinion and my view, and certainly backed up with data, have been through things like the GFC, COVID, when difficulties and adversity can actually make it more challenging. But I find in those most challenging times that people actually hone in on the things that matter.
There's a rallying, isn't there?
Absolutely.
So you've talked about culture, and I've heard you talk about culture before.
Yep.
I'm just picturing with your the reason that the stakeholder, like the board or whoever, are bringing you into an organisation, can that generate, what impact can that have on people as you arrive and they realise that this is a step up or a step into or a turnaround or whatever.
Yeah.
What do you often see with the broader team population when you get into an organization?
Well, the first reaction is always, why the hell are you here? Yeah. What are you going to do?
Yeah, I'm right. Sure.
And that's a always a challenging situation, especially when there are people inside the business who aspire to leadership roles. And they see you as a threat. I make it very clear, I guess two things I make very clear. One is why I'm credentialed enough to be here and in this role and you're not. And the fact that I'm not going to be here long term, and that is an opportunity if you get on the bus, yeah. Right? So from that point of view, there's always the initial resistance. But once you make it very clear why you're there, and I am big on communication, you can never overdo communication. And today there's never been better formats for communication. So we can be really effective in the way we do that. But make sure people understand what success looks like and what they're going to benefit from that success and how they're going to benefit. And some of that may well be development, maybe promotion paths, whatever. Mm. Right. But the reality is that the culture is the big killer. If you don't get that part right. And I've been in organizations where I've seen all the signs, all the posters, all the messages, and seen no evidence of any, you know, connection between the poster and reality.
Lots of people rowing on a still right. River. Yeah. Yeah.
So one of the reasons I get people to focus on the elite mindset, and we see that more so in sport than anywhere else. So all my sporting background comes into play here. But if you look at what an elite sports person does to be the very, very best, and they never accept that they're at their best, and then translate that into business, we see so often businesses underperforming because they don't have that elite mindset and they accept mediocrity. And there's nothing more demotivating for a hardworking member of the team to see that the organization is accepting mediocre performance.
So what is the elite mindset?
Well, it's some of those things that I've just mentioned, you know, that nothing is ever good enough. I know exactly what success looks like. I know what commitment I have and conviction I need to have to be successful.
Conviction's a great word there.
Absolutely, yeah. Right? I also know what systems and tools and measurements I need to keep measuring my performance, because if you can't measure it, you can't improve it. So they put in place all the systems and processes. The other key aspect of an elite person, an athlete in particular, is they have the right people around them.
Yeah.
So you look at even individual performers have a team of people, of experts, and they know exactly what they need, who they need, and what their role is in that success process.
Yep. You talked also about having a difficult conversation, and we've had podcasts here on, you know, models and approaches to a difficult conversation. How do you approach it?
Honesty and transparency is that simply. I also think it's really important that with authenticity, people understand that the reason you're having the conversation is because you actually care.
Yeah.
So I've been in situations where I've actually said to the person, I don't understand why you're still here. It could be, I don't think you're appreciated, or you're able to be the person you want to be, or have the success you want to have. And they've really appreciated that honesty. And then you help them move on. And I've actually helped them get other roles. And to this day, people I've let go still use me as a referee because they know that I care. And I think there's something about that authenticity and that transparency and having the honest conversation. I don't know why more people don't do it.
It's about people's own fear, isn't it, leaders? There's a classic conversation with Deborah Burt that I had a number of years ago. And she says it's because people avoid it because they're nervous of it, or nervous of the reaction, or whatever. But what,
or the consequence as well. So today with HR, the regulatory environment,
yep,
makes it also very, very difficult.
Yep.
So I can understand that nervousness.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so have you got some live examples of when you've, I mentioned a couple in the beginning.
Yeah.
You talked a bit about Federation Square with me earlier. Can you tell us what, because it's a really interesting story there. Tell us about that engagement.
The Federation Square.
In Melbourne, in Victoria, of course.
Yes. Yeah. So for those who have a history, a knowledge of Melbourne's history, will know that prior to Fed Square was the gas and fuel towers. So when I came in, Fed Square had been built, and we found when I did the research and I did that, those stage one processes, what I found was people were not necessarily happy with a whole lot of things about Fed Square. Wasn't green enough. It was dark and dingy during winter. The riverside was not safe. All those sort of aspects. And we then built a master plan, which everyone loved the concept of, including bringing Apple into the square. And it was interesting, one of the criticisms of Apple coming in was it was a retail giant, though Fed Square does have retail presence in the Melbourne landscape. But one of the things that was very telling for me was I went back to the architects of Fed Square. Now, people like Barry Humphreys always said that it was that we would remove the gas and fuel towers for something even more ugly, right? But Fed Square has that precinct aspect to it that can be really quite special, especially as a meeting place. Mm. So I spoke to the architects, and it was interesting in their conversation, in that conversation I had with them, is they said that Fed Square was meant to bring the Yarra River into the city, the heart of the city. And then we built along the river and blocked it off. So people had to walk almost 180 degrees around to get back into it.
Yeah, right.
So what we were proposing at the time was to open that up completely so that the river could come appear to be a lot closer through by activating the areas. Now, the whole precinct of Burong Ma has been opened up now, and there's a lot more activities. So we're really proud of the fact that we were able to create an activation site, which then got people more involved in the riverside. So now you see the restaurants there and the pubs. It's still a long way to go, and I'd still love to have seen Apple actually come into the precinct. Yeah. That's another story. But certainly the master plan was the bit that people really fell in love with. Mm. And we had people like Philip Johnson, who was a global landscape specialist who won the Chelsea Flower Show,
right,
giving us ideas around how we green the precinct. The ice skating rink we had there opened up Fed Square to the world. And we then saw in the years following ice skating rinks all around Melbourne. So that was one of those brilliant ideas as well. And then the activations with the tennis and the AFL and like. So I was really proud of what we achieved.
Mm. And so it sounds as if a lot of that is continuing on.
Yes. I think so. I think there'll always be criticism of Fed Square.
Well, it was controversial at the beginning, wasn't it?
It is, but it's unique. You look at some of the other cities now and around the world creating public squares for people to gather and share. I mean, some of the festivals that Fed Square run today are just wonderful opportunities to congregate and celebrate.
That's great. Really, thank you. Interesting. And as a Sydney sider, the idea of being on the water and making the water part of whatever the public space is makes so much sense.
Oh, and I think the development in Sydney along the waterways has been brilliant. Certainly past the quay. I think that looks brilliant what's happened there in such a short space of time. I think that's been transformed considerably.
Yes. Yeah, great. So sport, we have to talk about the Storm. So tell us about that, because that was that was a crisis period, wasn't it?
Yeah, I didn't need to manufacture that one.
No.
It wasn't hidden.
You didn't have to walk in and guess it.
Somewhat self-inflicted.
Yeah.
The backstory of that is that News Limited were looking at the time to sell Melbourne Storm. Sell its 50% stake in the NRL, but sell 100% of Melbourne Storm. So it was looking for a buyer. The salary cap saga blew that up.
You might want to talk a little bit about what that is or what happened there.
Yes. So on April the, I think it was 22nd, it was in 2010, the NRL announced that it had discovered that Melbourne Storm had breached the salary cap by a significant amount, imposed substantial penalties.
including taking away a premiership.
Two premierships, 2007, 2009. Now, this is also a club that, based in Melbourne, much to the chagrin of the Sydney clubs, especially when you consider Parramatta and Manly had lost those grand finals.
Yeah.
So, and further backstory to that is that Melbourne Storm won the 1999 grand final 2 years into the competition.
Yeah.
It really just, you know, was an issue for some of the Sydney clubs. So to have it responsible for a salary cap breach just highlighted, you know, you are cheats, you are this, you are that. And that was quite significant. But I think to go back to your question on that, News Limited then realised that whatever it had to sell, there was nothing there.
Yeah.
So my task was very, very simple. It was written into my contract that I was to get the club back to a position where it could be sold, any position whatsoever. I'm proud of the fact that within the 3 years that I was there, and we estimated it was a five-year project, in the 3 years I was there, we were able to turn around financially. We were able to win a minor premiership, within 2 years win the 2012 premiership. A bit of a proud moment there for anyone who's a Bulldog supporter, because the Bulldogs were able to renegotiate their contracts, we weren't. And when they won their premiership on the back of their breach in 2004, it was stated very categorically that Melbourne Storm wouldn't be able to repeat that feat, and we did. So that was substantial. What was really interesting with the Melbourne Storm situation was that culturally, the team on the field was an amazing group of people. The work that Frank Panisi and Craig Bellamy and the entire team did on the field was substantial. The fact that they had got to four grand finals, won two premierships, didn't convert to success off the field. So,
and what's success off the field for a league club or an AFL club?
If you look, when I arrived, there were about 8,000 members. Today, yes. The club is at 31,000,
right,
which exceeds the capacity of the new stadium, Amy Park. To me, that's a definition of success. But what I did, I use a term, optimization, organizational optimization. We looked at all the levers. What if we sold every seat for every game? What if every person, every supporter and member had two jerseys, right? So we introduced different jerseys through the process. So there was the merch aspect. There was the activation event. So we didn't want to see game day as just a game. If you look at the precinct now, it's a complete entertainment feast. So again, very, very proud of the things we introduced at the time to really activate the whole membership. The other thing too is I think Melbourne Storm saw itself as competing with the other clubs and codes in Melbourne. We ran the opposite direction. I'm very well connected in the other sports. So we got them to be, we would say to people, if you want to pick an AFL team, you've got, what, nine to choose from. You want to pick a soccer team, you've got two to choose from. You want to pick a rugby league team, you've got one to choose from, right? And we all love our sport in Melbourne, so let's get involved. So we had, even on Anzac Day, we had Essendon and Collingwood, rivals by day, Storm supporters by night. And we did things like that to just really activate the precinct. We got all Melburnians involved through Molly Meldrum. He did his I'm On Board campaign, and we got everyone supporting Storm. And to me, success looks like that activation, that engagement, that growth. And we were able to achieve that to the point where that five-year project, we were able to sell the club within 2 years and 10 months. It was in my contract to step down at that point. And I did so with a great deal of pride. Now, what the club has achieved since is far greater than whatever I did. But at least I can say I played a part in keeping the whole thing together, because the devastation that I discovered when I arrived, it was, if you want to look at demotivators, there were people that didn't want to be there. They felt betrayed by the owner, felt betrayed by the competition, the league, by the other clubs, you know, all those sort of emotions. And it was a very emotional point in time.
Yeah, I can imagine. I do know that, and that the coach has been consistent through the whole period. I mean, just as far as what good leadership looks like.
Oh, Craig could quite easily slot into a business leadership role, and I've said that to him. It's just, He is not only the best coach of any code in his country, but certainly the way he's managed himself, his people, his work ethic, his ability to engage. I mean, look at this young group coming through. There's not much of an age difference between Craig and I, and he's able to relate to that young group coming through. It's an amazing thing. But again, if you want to look at the key to part of Craig's success is the role that Frank Panisi has played.
Right.
And so Craig knows how to have the right people around him.
Yes, yes. So I love the examples are great. Two very Melbourne examples, but I think that applies everywhere.
Yeah.
What about a mid-sized business? What about a mid-sized business that's struggling with complacency, or there's absolutely capacity or opportunity? Not so much crisis, maybe.
Yeah.
How do you apply all of this to a mid-sized business?
Well, that's why it's so important to have a good strategic plan, right? Look, a lot of organizations say they have plans. Some of those plans are simple. Some of those are far too complex. But you need a plan. Without a plan, you're just going to succeed in failing.
Yeah,
so
succeed in failing. Right. I love that.
And I think the other thing too is we all know how we define doing the same thing over and expecting a different result, right? And a lot of organisations just plod along, and those middle sized organisations usually have either it's family business, stakeholder engagement. And they spend all their time working in the business instead of on the business. Yeah. And I'm often having to work with the executives to teach them the difference between on and in, right? So have a good plan, which involves all the tools, like the systems, the processes, the governance, the people, especially the people side. When I find that we sit down and do a strategic plan that defines success with very clear actions, then you start and explore, even if it's through innovation, but explore where the potential is. So I know my clients love the fact that I help them discover their potential and then realize that potential. And it's only then you think, gee, I am capable of this so much more. And if you talk to people in business and ask them why they got into it in the first place, and they'll give you all sorts of reasons, then you ask them my favorite question, so how's that working for you? They'll always come back with, yeah, it didn't quite work out. And it's because I think it starts with the plan.
Starts with a plan, discover potential and realize potential.
Yeah.
And I think it's a wonderful segue then into you are now a Vistage chair, which is very exciting. What drove that decision? Yeah. What drove that decision?
I've been doing what I've been doing for a long time. You use the word seasoned, which I always find interesting. And interesting is an interesting word. But I think what Vistage provides is an opportunity for me to move out of the one-to-one to the many-to-many. And then my job changes to just facilitate that conversation. I've seen lots of different models of similar concepts, but what I love about what Vistage offers is not only the methodology, but the brain power in the room. The ability for people to work with each other, support each other, coach each other, mentor each other, and if you use that, and we started with music, all I need to be is a good conductor.
Absolutely. Right?
And I love that model and love that concept. But even the people I've come into contact with, different caliber of people, and that in itself is exciting.
Yeah, it's great. So speaking of caliber, who do you want in your group then, Ron?
Well, I'm looking for executives who do want to take what they do to a whole new level. And I want people who think that they can teach and learn in that environment. So the contacts I intend to be reaching out to run their businesses that are between the 20 and 100 million easily, have a strong workforce, 25 plus.
Yes.
So for me, I'm looking for those organizations that have been doing okay but want to do a lot better, but also people who are leading those organizations who want to be better leaders.
Yes.
Because that to me is the key. So If you are in a leadership position and you feel that you can be a better leader by having the right people around them, then that's of interest to me. I think the other aspect to this is, you know, I'm on a speaking circuit. I speak about the loneliness of leadership. You've got leaders there who don't feel like they can go to their teams or their boards or, you know, those around them to get a comfortable conversation or to have a comfortable conversation, but also to get an innovative approach to things. So having a new set of eyes and ears around the table in a non-conflicting, confidential type environment is a great way to be challenged. And I'm looking for those people who are open to that as well.
And what are you looking to, how are you looking to learn and develop as a Vistage chair?
I said I was 66 and I'm still learning every day. And I love the fact that I've got people around me who can keep me challenged, keep me fresh, keep me energized and keep me learning. Mm-hmm. So with that body of people, and I talk about caliber, with that caliber of people around the table, I can only be the one that I think is going to learn the most.
It's really exciting. Number one, we don't talk about age very often on Vistage Live. You are the first guest to proudly lead with your age and you know, it's great, the wisdom of being a seasoned executive. Pat Lencioni talks about humble, hungry, smart, about that's what makes a good team player and a great leader. And Ron Gauci, I think you embody all three. Thank you for sharing your story and we're really excited to have you as a partner with Vistage. Thank you
so much.
So that's it for Vistage Live today. Thank you for joining us. Make sure you subscribe so you can listen to us each episode. And for more information about Vistage, check us out on vistage.com.au.